Undo and karate, that's useful. Let me show you some basic moves while we're waiting for Nicholas.
Where is he? Sophie asked, looking back over her shoulder at the house. What was going on in there? Is he asking Hecate to awaken our magical potential?
He is, Scatty affirmed.
But Hecate said that could kill us,
Josh said in alarm. He was beginning to suspect that Flamel's agenda was about more than just protecting him and his sister. The alchemist was up to something.
She was only guessing, Scatty said. She's always been a bit of a drama queen.
Then Nicholas is sure we're in no danger? Josh said.
No, he's not really sure,
Scatty smiled.
But believe me, you are in danger. The only difference is, if Hecate awakens you, then you'll be in grave danger.
Nicholas Flamel followed Hecate through the house. The young woman's fingers trailed along the walls, leaving streaks of bright wood touched with leaves and flowers in her wake.
I need your help, Hecate. I cannot do this alone, he called after her.
The goddess ignored him. She turned down a long, straight corridor and darted ahead. Her feet left little puddles of green grass that grew even as Flamel hurried after her. By the time he was halfway down the corridor, it was knee-high, then waist-high, and suddenly the entire corridor was covered in the tall, razor-sharp grass. Its blades whispered softly together, sounds that might almost have been words. Nicholas Flamel allowed a little of his growing anger to seep into his aura. Closing his right hand into a fist, he suddenly splayed his fingers, and the air was touched with the rich, tart odor of mint. The grass directly ahead of him flattened, as if it had been hit with a strong wind, and the alchemist was just in time to see the young woman step into a room set slightly apart from the rest of the house. If he had delayed a moment longer, he would have walked right past the opening.
Enough of these games, Flamel snapped, stepping into the room.
Hecate spun to face him. She had aged in the few moments she had spent running down the corridor. She now looked about 15. Her face was set in an ugly mask, and her yellow eyes were bitter.
How dare you speak to me that way?
She raised her hands threateningly.
You know what I can do to you?
You would not dare, Flamel said with a calm that he did not feel.
And why not?
Hecate asked, surprised. She was not used to being contradicted.
Because I am the guardian of the book.
The book you lost!
I am also the guardian who appears in the prophecies in the book, Flamel snapped.
The next to last guardian, he added.
The twins also appear in the book.
You say you knew Abraham. You know then how accurate his prophecies and foretellings were.
He was often wrong, Hecate muttered.
As guardian, I'm asking you to do something I believe to be essential to the survival of not only the elder race, but humanity too. I want you to awaken the twins' magical potential.
It could kill them,
the goddess stated flatly. She didn't really care if the Himani cattle lived or died.
That is a possibility,
Flamel admitted, feeling something icy settle in the pit of his stomach.
But if you do not help us, then their deaths are a certainty.
Hecate turned and walked to the window. Across the sloping lawn, Skatok was demonstrating a series of punches for the twins. They were smoothly mimicking her moves. Flamel went to join Hecate by the window.
What a world we live in, he commented, sighing, when everything, possibly even the continuance of the human race, lies on the shoulders of those teenagers.
You know why the Humani triumphed and the elder race was ultimately banished?
Hecate asked suddenly.
Because of iron, wasn't it?
Yes, because of iron. We survived the fall of Danu Talis, we survived the flood and the age of ice, and then, about 3,000 years ago, a single metal worker who had been crafting in bronze began to experiment in the new metal. He was just one man. And yet he managed to wipe out an entire race of people and a way of life. Great change always comes down to the actions of a single person.
Hecate fell silent, watching the twins punch and kick next to Skatok.
"Silver and gold, the rarest of all auras," she muttered.
And for a single heartbeat, the auras bloomed around the twins.
"If I do this and it kills them, will you be able to live with it on your conscience?"
"I am old now. So old," Nicholas said very softly. "Do you know how many friends I've buried over the centuries?"
"And did you feel their loss?"
There was a note of genuine curiosity in Hecate's voice. "Everyone."
"Do you still?"
"Yes. Every day." The goddess reached out and placed her hand on his shoulder.
"Then you are still human, Nicholas Flamel. The day you stop caring is the day you become like Dee and his kind."
She turned back to the garden and looked at the twins. They were both trying and failing to land blows on Skatok, who was ducking and weaving, though not moving from the one spot. From the distance, they looked like three ordinary teenagers practicing a new dance. But Hecate knew that there was nothing ordinary about any of them.
"I'll do it," she said eventually. "I'll awaken their powers. The rest is up to you. You will have to train them."
Flamel bowed his head so she would not see the tears in his eyes. If the twins survived the awakening, then there was a chance, albeit a slim one, that he would get to see Perronel again. "Tell me," he began, then coughed to clear his throat. "The man who discovered how to process iron, that blacksmith 3,000 years ago, what happened to him?"
"I killed him,"
Hecate said, her yellow eyes wide and innocent.
"His actions destroyed us. What else could I do? But it was too late. The secret of iron had been introduced into the world."
Flamel looked at the twins, watched Josh haul his sister to her feet, watched her hook a leg behind his and drop him to the ground. Their laughter hung bright and clear in the pre-dawn air. He prayed that they were not too late this time. Chapter 23. The cats of San Francisco left the city in the dead of night. Singly and in pairs, feral and scarred street cats, plump, smooth-coated house cats, all shapes, every size, purebred and mixed, long-haired and short-haired, they moved through the shadows in a silent feline wave. They surged across the bridges, boiled through alleys, raced through the tunnels beneath the streets, leapt across roofs. All heading north. They darted past shocked and terrified late-night revelers, skirted rats and mice without stopping to feed, ignored birds' nests. And although they moved in complete silence, their passage was marked by an extraordinary sound. That night, the city of San Francisco echoed with the primeval howls of 100,000 dogs. Dr. John Dee was unhappy, and just a little bit frightened. It was all very well to talk about attacking Hecate in her own shadow realm, but it was another thing entirely to sit at the entrance to her invisible kingdom and watch the cats and birds arrive, called by their respective mistresses, Bastet and the Morrigan. What could those small creatures do against the ancient magic of Hecate of the Elder Race? Dee sat in a huge black Hummer alongside Senuhet, the man who acted as Bastet's servant. Neither of them had spoken during the short flight in Dee's private jet from L.A. to San Francisco earlier, though there were 1,000 questions Dee wanted to ask the older man. Over the years, he had come to recognize that the servants of the Dark Elders, like himself, did not like to be questioned. They had reached the entrance to Hecate's shadow realm close to 2 o'clock, and were in time to see the first of the Morrigan's creatures arriving. The birds swooped in from the north and east in long, dark flocks, the only sound the snapping of their wings, and settled in the trees in Mill Valley, gathering so thickly that some of the branches cracked beneath the strain. Over the next few hours, the cats arrived. They poured out of the darkness in a never-ending stream of fur and then stopped, all facing the hidden opening to the shadow realm. Dee looked out his car window. He couldn't see the ground. It was covered, as far as he could see in every direction, with cats. Finally, just as the eastern horizon began to pale with salmon-colored light, Senuhet lifted a small black statue from a bag he wore around his neck and placed it on the dashboard. It was a beautifully carved Egyptian cat no bigger than his little finger.
"It is time," he said softly.
The eyes of the black statue glowed red.
"She is coming," Senuhet said.
"Why didn't we attack earlier, when Hecate slept?"
Dee asked. Despite several hundred years of study about the Dark Elders, he realized that, in truth, he knew very little. But that gave him some comfort, because he realized that they knew equally little about humans. Senuhet waved his hand, gesturing to the gathered birds and cats.
"We needed our allies," he said shortly.
Dee nodded. He guessed that Bastet was even now moving through the various shadow realms that bordered the human world. The Elder race's aversion to iron meant that certain modern conveniences, like cars and planes, were off-limits to them. His thin lips curled in a humorless smile. That was why they needed people like him and Senuhet to act as their agents. He felt, rather than saw, the birds move in the trees, half a million, maybe more, heads turned to the west. He followed their gaze, looking toward the darkest spot in the sky. At first, he could see nothing, but then a shape appeared high in the heavens, noticeable only because it blotted out the stars. The Morrigan was coming. Dee knew that at the heart of every legend, there is a grain of truth. Looking up into the night sky, watching the pale-faced creature appear out of the west, her feathered cloak spread behind her like enormous wings, Dee believed he knew where the legends of the Nosferatu vampires originated. Over the course of his long life, he had met vampires, real ones, and none of them were as terrifying as the Crow Goddess. The Morrigan settled to the ground directly in front of the Hummer, cats scattering at the last moment as she folded her cloak and landed. In the gloom, only the white oval of her face was visible. Her eyes were as black as night, looking like holes burned in paper. Then the cats growled, a low rumbling that trembled through the very air, and Bastet stepped out of the shadows. The cat goddess was wearing the white cotton robes of an Egyptian princess and holding a spear that was as tall as she was. She strode through the sea of cats, which parted before her and closed in behind. Towering over the Morrigan, she bowed deeply to the Crow Goddess.
"Nis, is it time?"
she purred.
"It is,"
the Morrigan replied, returning the bow. Shrugging back her cloak, she revealed a long bow strapped across her shoulders. She unslung the bow and notched an arrow from the quiver at her hip. Then, turning as one, the two Dark Elders raced toward the seemingly impenetrable hedge and leapt through. The cats and birds flowed after them.
"Now it begins,"
Senuhet said gleefully, gathering his weapons, two curved Egyptian bronze swords, and climbing out of the car. Or ends, Dee thought, but kept his fears to himself. Friday, 1st June. Chapter 24. Josh stood at the edge of the ancient forest with his sister and watched a trio of tiny winged creatures that looked astonishingly like dragons whirl and dance through the first shafts of dawn sunlight. Josh glanced at her, then looked quickly away.
"I don't want you to do this," he said quickly.
Sophie laid her hand on her brother's arm.
"Why not?"
she said. She moved in front of her twin, forcing him to look at her. Over her left shoulder, in front of the entrance to the incredible Yggdrasil, she could see Flamel, Skatti, and Hecate watching them. All around, thousands of Torque Alta, both in their human and wereboar forms, were scurrying about, preparing for battle. The boars wore plates of leather armor across their haunches and backs, and the human Torque Alta were carrying bronze spears and swords. Huge flocks of Nahair swooped across the skies and the bushes, and tall grasses were alive with unseen, crawling, slithering, scuttling creatures.
Guards were taking up positions all around the Yggdrasil, clambering out onto the huge branches, standing guard with bows and spears in every window. Sophie looked into her brother's bright blue eyes. She could see herself reflected there, and she abruptly realized that his eyes were magnified behind unshed tears. She reached for him, but he caught her hand and squeezed her fingers gently. "I don't want anything to happen to you," he said simply. Sophie nodded, unwilling to trust herself to speak. She felt exactly the same way about her twin. Three of the enormous pterosaur-like Nahair flew overhead, the downdraft of their wings sending plumes of dust along the ground below. Neither Sophie nor Josh looked up.
"Nicholas said that there are risks," Josh continued, "but Hecate said that it's dangerous, possibly even deadly. I don't want you to go through with this awakening in case something goes wrong," he finished quickly.
"We have to do it. Nicholas said..."
"I'm not entirely sure I trust him," Josh interrupted. "I have a feeling he's up to something. He's too eager for Hecate to awaken our powers despite the dangers."
"He said it's our only chance," Sophie persisted.
"Yesterday he said he had to get us away from the shop to keep us safe. Now, all of a sudden, we have to be trained so that we can protect ourselves from Dee and these dark elders? Trust me, Sophie, Nicholas Flamel is playing his own game."
Sophie's gaze drifted to the alchemist. She'd known him for a couple of months, and she remembered writing in her blog that she thought he was cool. Of course, now she realized that she really didn't know him at all. The man she'd thought of as Nick Fleming was an imposter, a lie. Flamel was staring intently at her, and for the briefest of moments, she imagined that he knew what they were talking about.
"Both of us don't have to go through this awakening," Josh continued. "Let me do it."
Again, Sophie looked into his eyes.
"How do you think I'd feel if something happened to you?"
This time, it was Josh who found he couldn't speak. The idea that something terrible could happen to his sister had only occurred to him a little while before, but the very thought of it terrified him. Sophie took her brother's hands in hers.
"From the moment we were born, we've done everything together," she said, her voice low and serious. "And with Mom and Dad away so much, it's really always been just you and me. You've always looked after me. I've always looked out for you. I'm not going to allow you to go through this process by yourself. We'll do this just like we've done everything else together."
Josh looked long and hard at his sister.
"Are you sure?" he asked. He was beginning to see a new Sophie. "I've never been more sure."
They both knew what remained unsaid. Neither wanted to be left behind if anything happened during the awakening. Josh finally nodded. He then squeezed his sister's hand, and they both turned to face the alchemist, Hecate, and Skadi. "We're ready," the twins said.
"The Morrigan is here,"
Skadi informed them as they followed Nicholas and Hecate through the huge door into the heart of the tree. She had changed into black pants, a high-necked black t-shirt that left her arms bare, and thick-soled combat boots. She wore two short swords strapped to her back, the hilts protruding slightly over her shoulders, and had daubed her eyes and cheekbones with a black dye that gave her face a startlingly skull-like appearance.
"She's brought Bastet with her. They're already surging into the Shadow Realm."
"Hecate can hold them back, can't she?" Sophie asked.
She only had an inkling of the goddess's powers, but the thought that there was something more powerful than her was terrifying. Skadi shrugged.
"I have no idea. They've arrived in force. They've brought their armies with them."
"Armies?"
Josh echoed. "What kind of armies? More mud people?"
"No golems this time. They have brought the birds of the air and the cats of the earth with them."
Sophie laughed shakily.
"Birds and cats? What can they do?"
Skadi glanced at the girl, the whites of her eyes startling against the black war paint.
"You saw what the birds did to the car on the way here."
Sophie nodded, suddenly feeling sick in the pit of her stomach. Images of the filthy black crows battering the windshield and pecking holes in the metal hood would haunt her to her dying day.
"Well, imagine what would happen if tens of thousands of birds gathered."
"Tens of thousands,"
Sophie whispered.
More like hundreds of thousands, Scatty said, turning into a narrow corridor. Then the Hare Scouts estimate maybe 500,000.
And didn't you say something about cats?
Josh asked.
Yes, I did. More than we can count.
Josh looked at his sister, the realization of the terrible danger they faced really beginning to sink in now. They could die in this strange shadow realm, and no one would ever know. He felt tears prickling his eyes and blinked them away. Their parents would spend the rest of their lives wondering what had happened to them. The corridor they were following turned into another, even narrower passageway. The ceiling was so low that both twins had to walk with their heads ducked down. There were no steps or stairs, but the corridor circled down and down in a long, slow spiral. The twins realized that they were going into the ground deep beneath the tree. The walls became darker, the smooth wood now scarred with straggling roots that curled out and pulled at their hair with clutching fingers. The air turned damp, perfumed with loam and fresh earth, rotting leaves and new growth.
The house is alive,
Sophie said in wonder as they turned into another twisting, spiraling corridor that was completely composed of the gnarled and bulbous roots of the great tree that rose above them.
Even with us moving around inside, with the rooms and the windows and the pools, it's still a living tree.
She found the idea both astonishing and frightening at the same time.
This tree was grown from a seed of the Yggdrasil, the world tree,
Scatty said quietly, rubbing the palm of her hand against the exposed roots. She brought her palm to her face and breathed deeply, drawing in the aroma.
Millennia ago, when Danu Talis sank beneath the waves, a few of the elders were able to rescue some of the flora and fauna and transplant it to other lands. But only two of the elders, Hecate and Odin, managed to nurture their Yggdrasil seeds to life. Odin, like Hecate, had power over magic.
Josh frowned, trying to remember what little he knew about Odin. Wasn't he the one-eyed Norse god? But before he could ask, Hecate disappeared into an opening framed by knots of twisted roots. Nicholas Flamel stopped and waited for the twins and Scatty to catch up. His pale eyes were deeply shadowed, and a thin vertical crease showed between his eyebrows. When he spoke, he chose his words with care, his nervousness making his French accent even more pronounced.
"I wish you did not have to do this," he said, "but you must believe me when I say that there is no other way."
He reached out and put one hand on Sophie's right shoulder and one on Josh's left shoulder. Their auras, silver and gold, flared briefly, and the heavy air was touched with the scents of vanilla ice cream and oranges.
"I'm afraid that when you helped Paranel and me, you placed yourselves in the most dreadful danger. When Hecate awakens your magical potential, I will teach you some protective spells, and there are others I will take you to, specialists in the 5 ancient forms of magic. I'm hoping they will complete your training."
"We're going to be trained as magicians?"
Sophie asked. She guessed she should be more excited, but she kept remembering Scatty's words, that once Hecate awakened their powers, they would be in grave danger.
"As magicians and sorcerers, as necromancers, warlocks, and even enchanters," Flamel smiled.
He glanced over his shoulder, then turned back to the twins.
"Now, go inside and do whatever she tells you. I know you are afraid, but try not to be. Let me tell you, there is no shame in fear."
He smiled, his lips curling upward, but the smile never reached his troubled eyes.
"When you come out of that room, you will be different people."
"I don't want to be a different person," Sophie whispered.
She wanted everything to be just as it had been a couple of hours earlier, when everything was ordinary and boring. Right now, she would give anything to go back to a boring world. Flamel stepped back from the doorway and ushered the twins inside.
"From the moment you laid eyes on Dee, you started to change. And once begun, change cannot be reversed."
It was dark inside the chamber, whose walls were composed entirely of knotted and twisted roots. Sophie could feel her brother's hand in hers, and she squeezed his fingers slightly. His hand tightened in return. As the twins moved deep into the hollow, which was obviously larger than it had first seemed, their eyes gradually adjusted to the gloom, and the room took on a greenish glow. Thick, furry moss covered the twisted roots and radiated a watery jade green light, making it appear as if everything were underwater. The air was heavy with moisture, and drops of liquid gathered on their hair and skin like tiny beads of sweat. Although it wasn't cold, they both shivered.
"You should consider yourselves honored,"
Hecate's voice came from the green gloom directly ahead of them.
"I have not awakened a Shumani for many generations."
"Who?"
Josh began, and then his voice cracked. He gave a dry cough and tried again.
"Who was the last human you awakened?"
He was determined not to let his fear show.
"It was some time ago, in the 12th century, as you Humani measure time, a man from the land of the Scots. I do not remember his name."
Both Sophie and Josh instinctively knew that Hecate was lying.
"What happened to him?"
Sophie asked.
"He died."
There was a peculiar, high-pitched giggle.
"He was killed by a hailstone."
"Must have been some hailstone," Josh whispered.
"Oh, it was,"
Hecate murmured. And in that moment, they both knew that she had something to do with the mysterious man's death. To Josh, the goddess suddenly seemed like a vindictive child.
"So what happens now?"
Josh asked.
"Do we stand or sit or lie down?"
"You do nothing,"
Hecate snapped.
"And this is not something to be done lightly. For thousands of generations, you Humani have deliberately distanced yourselves from what you laughingly call magic. But magic is really only the utilization of the entire spectrum of the senses. The Humani have cut themselves off from their senses. Now they see only in a tiny portion of the visible spectrum, hear only the loudest of sounds, their sense of smell is shockingly poor, and they can only distinguish the sweetest and sourest of tastes."
The twins were aware that Hecate was moving about them now. They couldn't hear her move, but were able to track her by the sound of her voice. When she spoke from behind them, they both jumped.
"Once, mankind needed all those senses simply to survive."
There was a long pause, and when she spoke again, she was so close that her breath ruffled Sophie's hair.
"Then, the world changed. Danutalis sank beneath the waves. The age of the lizards passed, the time of ice came, and the Humani grew sophisticated."
She made the word into a curse.
"The Humani grew indolent and arrogant. They found that they did not need all their senses, and gradually they lost them."
"You're saying we lost the powers of magic because we grew lazy," Josh said. Sophie suppressed a groan. One of these days, her brother was going to get them into real trouble. But when Hecate replied, her voice was surprisingly soft, almost gentle.
"What you call magic is nothing more than an act of the imagination fired by the senses, then given shape by the power of your aura. The more powerful the aura, the greater the magic. You, too, have extraordinary potential within you. The alchemist is correct. You could be the greatest magicians the world has ever known. But here's the problem,"
Hecate continued, and now the room grew a little lighter, and they could see the shape of the woman standing in the center of the room, directly beneath a tangle of roots that looked exactly like a clutching hand reaching down from the roof.
"The Humani have learned to live without their senses. The brain filters so much data from your consciousness that you live in a type of fog. What I can do is awaken your dormant powers, but the danger, the very real danger, is that it will overload your senses."
She stopped, then asked,
"Are you prepared to take that risk?"
"I am,"
Sophie said immediately, before her brother could protest. She was afraid that if he made a quip, the goddess would do something to him. Something ugly and lethal. The goddess turned to look at Josh. He sought out his sister in the gloom. The green light lent her face a sickly cast. The awakening was going to be dangerous, possibly even deadly, but
but he could not allow Sophie to go through it on her own. "I'm ready," he said defiantly.
"Then we will begin."
Chapter 25. Dee waited until the last of the birds and cats had disappeared into Hecate's shadow realm before he left the car and strolled toward the hidden opening. Senuhet, Bastet's servant, had left earlier, eagerly following his mistress into the shadow realm, but Dee had not been quite so enthusiastic. It was always a bad idea to be first into battle. The soldiers in the rear were the ones who tended to survive. He was guessing that Hecate's guards had massed just beyond the invisible wall, and he had no inclination to be first through the opening. It didn't make him a coward, he reasoned. It just made him careful, and being careful had kept him alive for many hundreds of years. But he couldn't hang around out there forever. His inhuman masters would expect to see him on the battlefield. The small man drew his $2,000 leather coat tightly around his shoulders the moment before he stepped into the opening, leaving behind the chill early morning air and stepping into a battlefield. There were bodies everywhere, and none of them were human. The Morrigan's birds had changed when they entered Hecate's shadow realm. They had become almost human, though not entirely so. They were now tall and thin like their mistress. Their wings had stretched, becoming long and bat-like, connected to human-shaped bodies by translucent skin and tipped with deadly claws. Their heads were still those of birds. There were a few cats scattered among the field of feathers. They, too, had become almost human when they stepped into the shadow realm, and like Bastet, they had retained their cat heads. Their paws were a cross between human hands and cat claws, tipped with curved, razor-sharp nails, and their bodies were covered in a fine down of hair. Looking around, Dee could see no sign that any of Hecate's guards had fallen in battle, and was suddenly frightened. What did the goddess have guarding her realm? He reached under his coat, pulled out the sword that had once been called Excalibur, and set off down the path to where the huge tree rose out of the morning mist. The sunrise ran blood-red along the ancient black blade. "Birdmen," Skethawk muttered, and then added a curse in the ancient Celtic language of her youth. She hated birdmen. They gave her hives. She was standing at the entrance to the Yggdrasil, watching the creatures appear out of the forest. The mythologies of every race included stories of men who turned into birds, or birds who transformed into half-human creatures. In her long life, Skatti had encountered many of the creatures, and had once come perilously close to death when she'd fought a siren, an owl with the head of a beautiful woman. Since that encounter, she'd been allergic to bird feathers. Already her skin was starting to itch, and she could feel a sneeze building at the back of her nose. The Morrigan's creatures moved awkwardly, like hunched-over humans dragging their knuckles on the ground. They were poor warriors, but they often succeeded by sheer force of numbers. Then Bastet's cat people appeared. They moved slowly, stealthily, some standing on 2 feet, but most moving on all fours. Here, Skatti knew, was the basis of the great cat legends of Africa and India. Unlike the birds, the cat people were deadly fighters. They were lightning fast, and their claws were capable of inflicting terrible damage. Skethawk sneezed. She was also allergic to cats. The strange army came to a halt, perhaps awed by the incredible building-sized tree, or just confused by the sight of a single warrior standing framed in the open doors. They milled about, then, as if driven by a single command, they surged forward in a long, ragged line. The warrior twisted her head from side to side and rolled her shoulders, and then her 2 short swords appeared in her hands. She raised them above her head in an X. It was the signal the Torque Alta and the Nahair had been waiting for. Seemingly from nowhere, hundreds of the terrifying lizards hurtled out of the sky with the sun at their backs and swooped over the advancing army. They flew in great sweeping circles, their huge wings raising enormous plumes of gritty dust that blinded and confused the birds and cats. Then the Torque Alta, who had been lying concealed in the tall grass and behind the twisting roots of the Yggdrasil, rose in the middle of the attackers. As Skadi hurried back into the depths of the house, she realized how closely the noises of the battle resembled feeding time at the San Francisco Zoo.
"We're running out of time,"
Skathawk yelled to Flamel as she raced into the corridor. "How many?" Nicholas asked grimly.
"Too many,"
Skadi replied. She paused briefly and then added,
"The Torque Alta and the Hare will not be able to hold them for long."
"And the Morrigan and Bastet?"
"I didn't see them, but you can be sure they're coming. And when they do..."
She left the sentence unfinished. With Hecate busy awakening the twins, nothing would be able to stand against the two Dark Elders.
"They'll come," he said grimly.
Skadi stepped closer to Flamel. They had known each other for over 300 years, and although she was his senior by nearly 2 millennia, she had come to regard him as the father she no longer remembered.
"Take the twins and flee. I'll hold him here. I'll buy you as much time as possible."
The alchemist reached out and placed his hand on the warrior's shoulder and squeezed. A tiny pop of energy snapped between them, and they both briefly glowed. When he spoke, he unconsciously reverted to the French language of his youth.
"No, we'll not do that. When we leave here, we go together. We need the twins, Skadi. Not just you and me, but the entire world. I believe that only they will be able to stand against the Dark Elders and keep them from achieving their ultimate aim and reclaiming the Earth."
Skadi looked over his shoulder into the gloomy chamber.
"You're asking a lot of them. When are you going to tell them the whole truth?"
she asked.
"In time," he began.
"Time is something you do not have,"
Skadi murmured.
"You've started to age. I can see it in your face, around your eyes, and there's more gray in your hair."
Flamel nodded.
"I know. The immortality spell is breaking down. Perronel and I will begin to age a year for every day we go without the formulation for immortality. We will be dead by the end of the month. But by then, it will not matter. If the Dark Elders succeed, the world of the Humani will have already ceased to exist."
"Let's make sure that doesn't happen."
Skadi turned her back on Flamel, then sank to the ground, back straight, her legs folded, feet turned high on her thighs in the full lotus position, arms outstretched, palms wrapped around the hilts of the swords that were lying across her lap. If the cats or birds broke into the house and found the corridor, they would have to get past her to find Hecate, and the warrior would make them pay dearly. Hecate had given Flamel a short staff made of a branch of the Yggdrasil, and now, holding it in both hands, he took up a position directly outside the door to the chamber where the goddess was working with the twins. If any of the invaders did manage to get past Skathawk, they would then face him. Skadi would fight with her swords, hands, and feet, but his weapons were potentially even more destructive. He held up his hand, and the narrow space grew heavy with the smell of mint as his aura flickered and sparked into green life around him. Though he was still powerful, every use of magic weakened him and drew on his life force. Skadi was right. He had started to age. He could feel tiny aches and vague pains where there had been none before. Even his eyesight was no longer as sharp as it had been only the day before. If he was forced to use his powers, it would speed the aging process, but he was determined to give Hecate all the time she needed. He turned to look over his shoulder, trying to penetrate the gloom. What was happening in there?
"We will start with the Elder," Hecate announced.
Sophie could feel her brother drawing a breath to protest, but she squeezed his fingers so tightly that she could actually feel his bones grinding together. He kicked her ankle in response.
"It is traditional,"
the goddess continued.
"Sophie."
She paused, then said,
"What is your family name, your parents' names?"
"Newman. And my mother's name is Sarah. My father is Richard."
It felt odd calling her parents anything other than Mom and Dad. The green light in the chamber brightened, and they could see Hecate outlined against the glowing walls. Although her face was in darkness, her eyes reflected the green light like chips of polished glass. She reached out and placed the palm of her hand against Sophie's forehead.
Sophie, daughter of Sarah and Richard, of Clan Newman, of the race Humani.
She began in English, but then drifted into a lyrically beautiful language that predated humanity. As she spoke, Sophie's aura began to glow, a misty silver light outlining her body. A cool breeze wafted across her skin, and she was suddenly conscious that she was no longer hearing Hecate. She could see the goddess's mouth moving, but she could not make out the words over the sounds of her own body, the breath hissing in and out of her nose, the rush of blood in her ears, the solid beat of her heart in her chest. There was a pressure on her temples, as if her brain were expanding inside her skull, and an ache ran the length of her spine and spread outward into all her bones. Then the room began to lighten. Hecate, looking older now, was standing outlined in shifting streams of sparkling lights. Sophie suddenly realized that she was seeing the goddess's aura. She watched as the lights twisted and curled around Hecate's arm and flowed down into her fingers, and then, with a tingling shock, Sophie could actually feel it penetrating her skull. For an instant she was dizzy, disorientated, and then, through the buzzing in her ears, Hecate's words abruptly started to make sense.
I awaken this terrible power within you.
The goddess moved her hands over Sophie's face, her touch like ice and fire.
These are the senses the Humani have abandoned,
Hecate continued. She pressed her thumbs lightly against Sophie's eyes.
To see with acuity.
Sophie's vision bloomed, and the darkened chamber came to blazing light, every shadow picked out in exquisite detail. She could see each thread and stitch on Hecate's robe, could pick out individual hairs on her head and follow the map of tiny wrinkles that were visibly growing at the corners of her eyes.
To hear with clarity.
It was as if cotton had been pulled from Sophie's ears. Suddenly, she could hear. It was like the difference between listening to music on her iPod headphones and then to the same track on her bedroom stereo. Every sound in the room magnified and intensified. The wheezing of her brother's breath through his nostrils, the tiny shifting creaks of the huge tree above them, the scratching of invisible creatures moving through the roots. Tilting her head slightly, she could even hear the distant sounds of battle, the screeching of birds, the roar of cats, and the bellowing of boars.
To taste with purity.
Hecate's fingers brushed Sophie's lips, and suddenly the girl was conscious that her tongue was tingling. She licked her lips, finding traces of the fruit she had eaten earlier, and discovering that she could actually taste the air. It was rich and earthy, and even distinguished the water droplets in the atmosphere.
To touch with sensitivity.
Sophie's skin came alive. The fabrics against her skin, the soft cotton of her t-shirt, the stiff denim of her jeans, the gold chain with her birth sign around her neck, her warm cotton socks, all left different and distinct impressions on her flesh.
To smell with intensity.
Sophie actually rocked backward with the sudden eye-watering explosion of scents that invaded her. The spicy otherworldly odors of Hecate, the cloying earthiness of her surroundings, her brother's 24-hour deodorant, which was plainly not working, the supposedly unscented gel in his hair, the mint of the toothpaste she had used earlier. Sophie's aura began to glow, silver mist rising off her skin like fog off a lake. It surrounded her body in a pale oval. She closed her eyes and threw her head back. Colors, smells, and sounds were rushing at her, and they were brighter, stronger, louder than any she had ever experienced before. The effect from her heightened senses was almost painful. No, it was painful. It hurt. Her head throbbed, her bones ached, even her skin itched. Everything was just too much. Sophie's head tilted back, and then, almost of their own accord, her arms shot out to either side, and she rose 4 inches off the dirt floor.
Sophie,
Josh whispered, unable to keep the terror from his voice.
Sophie.
His sister, wrapped in an undulating silver glow, was floating in the air directly before him. The light from her body was so strong that it painted the circular chamber in shades of silver and black. It was like a scene from a terrifying horror movie.
Don't touch her, Hecate commanded sternly. Her body is attempting to assimilate the wash of sensations. This is the most dangerous time.
Josh's mouth went dry, and his tongue was suddenly too big for it.
Dangerous? What do you mean, dangerous?
Something in his mind clicked, and he felt as if his worst fears were about to be realized.
In most cases, the brain cannot cope with the heightened sensations of awakening.
In most cases? He whispered, appalled.
In almost every case, Hecate said,
and he heard the regret in her voice.
That is why I was unwilling to do this.
Josh asked the question he really didn't want answered.
What happens?
The brain effectively shuts down. The person is left in a coma from which they never awaken.
And Flamel knew this could happen?
Josh asked, feeling a great surge of anger begin in the pit of his stomach. He felt sick. The alchemist had known the awakening could, in all likelihood, send him and Sophie into a coma, and yet had still been prepared to let them go through with it. The rage burned within him, fueled in equal parts by fear and a terrible sense of betrayal. He'd thought Flamel was his friend. He'd been wrong.
Of course, Hecate said. He told you that there were dangers, didn't he?
He didn't tell us everything, Josh snapped.
Nicholas Flamel never tells anyone everything.
One side of Hecate's face was touched with a silver light radiating from Sophie. The other was sheathed in black shadow. Suddenly, Hecate's nostrils flared and her eyes widened. She looked up at the ceiling of roots.
No!
She gasped.
No!
Sophie's eyes snapped open, and then she opened her mouth and screamed, Fire!
They're burning the world tree!
Hecate howled, her face contorted into a savage mask. Shoving Josh to one side, she darted out into the corridor, leaving him alone with the person who had once been his twin. He stared at the girl floating in the air before him, unsure what to do, afraid to even touch her. All he knew was that for the first time in their lives, they were different in ways he could not even begin to comprehend. Chapter 26.
We need to go.
Nicholas Flamel caught Josh's shoulder and shook him, bringing him back to the present. Josh turned to look at the alchemist. There were tears on his cheeks, but he was unaware of them.
Sophie, he whispered.
It's going to be fine,
Nicholas said firmly. Shouts echoed in the corridor outside, the sudden clash of weapons mingling with the roars of humans and animals. Above it all rose Skatok's delighted laughter. Flamel reached for Sophie, who was still floating 4 inches above the earth, and his aura flared white-green when he took her hand. Gently, he pulled her back to the ground. As soon as her feet touched the earth, it was as if all the strength had left her body, and he caught her before she crumpled to the floor, unconscious. Josh was immediately at his sister's side. He pushed Flamel away and held his twin in his arms. Crackling energy darted from Sophie's fading aura to his flesh, but he didn't even register the tiny stings. When he looked up at Flamel, his face was an angry mask.
You knew, he accused. You knew how dangerous this was. My sister could have been left in a coma.
I knew that was not going to happen, Nicholas said calmly, crouching down beside Josh. Her aura, your aura, is too strong. I knew you would both survive. I would never have deliberately placed either of you in danger. I swear that.
He reached for Sophie's wrist to check her pulse, but Josh pushed his hand away. He didn't believe him. He wanted to, but somehow Flamel's words rang false. They both jumped up as an agonized, cat-like squeal came from the corridor outside. It was followed by Scatty's voice.
We really should be leaving.
and right now would be a good time.
The smell of burning wood was stronger, and tendrils of gray smoke began to curl into the chamber.
"We've got to go. We can talk about this later," Flamel said firmly.
"You better believe we will," Josh promised.
"I'll help you carry her," the alchemist offered.
"I can do it myself,"
Josh said, and gathered his sister into his arms. He wasn't going to trust Sophie to anyone else. He was surprised by how light she felt, and he was suddenly thankful for all those painful months of football practice that had made him stronger than he looked.
The alchemist picked up the short staff he'd left propped against the wall and spun it in the air before him. The tip glowed green, and it left the faintest of smoking emerald trails in the air.
"Ready?"
Flamel asked.
Josh, his sister held tightly against his chest, nodded.
"Whatever happens, whatever you see, don't stop, don't turn back. Just about everything outside this doorway will not hesitate to kill you."
Josh followed Flamel through the door and immediately stopped, frozen in shock. Scatty was standing in the center of the narrow corridor, her two short swords a blur before her. Behind the swords, crowding the corridor, were some of the most terrifying creatures he had ever seen. He'd been expecting monsters. What he had not been expecting were creatures even more terrifying. Creatures that were neither beast nor human, but something caught in between. Humans with the heads of cats snarled and slashed at Scatty, their claws striking sparks off her swords. Others with the bodies of men, but with the huge, peaked skulls of ravens jabbed at her, attempting to gouge and stab her.
"Scatty, down!"
Flamel shouted.
Without waiting to see if she even heard him, he stretched out his arm and leveled the short staff. His aura flared green, and the air was suddenly bitter with the odor of mint. An emerald-colored glow of spinning light gathered at the tip of the staff and then shot forward with an audible pop. Scatty barely managed to duck before the ball sizzled through the air and shattered against the ceiling almost directly over her head. It left a bright mark, like a stain, which started to dribble and drip sticky green light. The scarred head of a tabby cat pushed through the opening, mouth gaping, fangs glinting. It spotted Scatty and lunged for her, and a drop of the gooey light splashed off the top of its head. The cat-headed human went wild. It threw itself back into the corridor, where it immediately attacked everything in its path. A birdman stepped up to the opening and was doused in the dripping green light. Its black wings abruptly developed holes and tears, and it fell back with a hideous, chattering cawing. Josh noticed that although the green light, which had the consistency of honey, burned the creatures, it had no effect on the wood. He knew he should be paying more attention, but all his concern was focused on his sister. She was breathing quickly, and behind her closed eyelids, her eyes were dancing. Scatty scrambled to her feet and darted back to Flamel and Josh.
"Very impressive, I'm sure," she muttered. "I didn't know you could do that."
Flamel spun the staff like a baton.
"This focuses my power."
Scatty looked around.
"We seem to be trapped."
"Hecate went this way," Nicholas said, turning to the right and pointing to what looked like an impenetrable barrier of knotted roots.
"I saw her come running out of the chamber and walk straight through this."
He stepped up to the knotted wood and stretched out his arm. It disappeared right up to the elbow.
"I'll go first," Scatty said.
Josh noticed that although she had been fighting the deadly combination of birds and cats, there was neither a scratch on her body nor a hair out of place. She wasn't even breathing hard, though if she really was a vampire, then maybe she didn't need to breathe at all, he thought.
Scatty darted forward, and in the last moment before she reached the wall of roots, she dived straight into the opening, swords crossed over her chest. Flamel and Josh looked at one another in the brief moment that followed, and then Scatty's head poked through the solid-looking tangle of roots.
"All clear."
"I'll take the rear," Flamel said, stepping back to allow Josh to go ahead of him. "I'll deal with anything that follows us."
Josh nodded, unwilling to trust himself to talk to Flamel. He was still furious with the alchemist for endangering his sister's life, but he also recognized that Flamel was now fighting for them, placing himself in very real danger to protect them. Josh stepped up to the wall of twisted roots and packed earth, closed his eyes, and walked right through. There was an instant of damp chill, and then he opened his eyes to see Scatty directly in front of him. He was standing in a low, narrow chamber, created entirely from the Yggdrasil's gnarled roots. Clumps of green moss leaked a dim green light into the chamber, and he could see that Scatty was standing at the bottom of a set of narrow, irregular steps that led upward into the gloom. Scatty's head was tilted to one side, but before Josh could ask what she was hearing, Flamel stepped through the wall. He was smiling, and the top of his staff emitted traces of green gas. That should hold them for a while.
"Let's go,"
Scatty called as soon as the alchemist appeared. The stairway was so narrow that Josh was forced to move in a sideways crab crawl, head ducked low, with Sophie held close to his body to prevent her head and legs from cracking against the rough wooden walls. He tested every step before he took it. He didn't want to risk falling and dropping his sister. He suddenly realized that these steps were cut into the space between the inner and outer bark of the great tree, and couldn't help wondering if a tree the size of Yggdrasil was riddled with secret passages, hidden rooms, forgotten chambers, and lost stairways. It must be, he decided. Did Hecate even know where they all were? And then, his mind racing, he wondered who had created these steps. Somehow, he could not imagine the goddess carving them out of the living wood herself. As they climbed, they could smell the bitter stench of burning wood, and the sounds of battle came clearer. The cat shrieks became even more human. The bird screeches were completely terrifying, and they mingled with the bellowing roars of the boars and the hissing of the Nahair. Now that the group was no longer underground, the heat and smoke intensified, and they began to hear another sound, a deep, bass, groaning rumble.
"We need to hurry," Scatty's voice drifted back out of the gloom. "We really need to hurry now."
And somehow the forced calm in the warrior's voice frightened Josh more than if she had screamed.
"Careful now. We've reached an opening. We're at the end of a thick root about 30 yards away from the main body of the tree. We're well clear of the fighting," she added.
Josh rounded a corner and discovered Scatty standing bathed in shafts of early morning sunshine that shone through a curtain of vines directly ahead of her. She turned to face him, sunlight turning her red hair golden and running along the blades of her short swords, and in that moment, Josh saw her as the ancient and terrifying warrior she was. The sounds of battle were all around them, but louder than all the other noises was the groaning rumble that seemed to vibrate deep in the ground.
"What is that sound?" he asked.
"The cries of the Yggdrasil,"
Scatty answered grimly.
"Hecate's enemies have set light to the world tree."
But why?
He found the very idea horrifying. This ancient living tree had harmed no one. But the action gave him an insight into the contempt with which the Dark Elders held life.
"Her powers are inextricably linked to it. Her magic brought it to towering life. Its life force keeps her strong. They believe that by destroying it, they will destroy her."
Flamel came panting up the steps to stand behind Josh. The alchemist's thin face was bright red and beaded with sweat.
"Getting old," he said with a wry smile. He looked at Scatty. "What's the plan?"
"Simple," she began. "We get away from here as quickly as possible."
Then she spun the sword in her left hand so that the blade was lying flat against the length of her arm. She pointed with the hilt. Flamel and Josh stood close to her and peered out through the curtain of vines. On the opposite side of the field, Dr. John Dee had appeared, moving cautiously through the undergrowth. The black-bladed short sword that he held in both hands glowed and flickered with a cold blue light.
"Dee," Flamel said, "never in my life would I have imagined being delighted to see him. This is good news indeed."
Both Scatty and Josh looked at him in surprise.
"Dee is human, which means that he came here via human transportation," the alchemist explained.
"A car," Scatty nodded in agreement, "that he would probably have left just outside the Shadow Realm."
Josh was about to ask how she knew he would have left it outside when he suddenly realized he knew the answer.
Because he knew if he drove it in here, the battery would be drained.
Look,
Scatty murmured. They watched one of the huge boar-like Torque Altas emerge from the long grass behind Dee. Although it was still in its beast shape, it rose on its hind legs until it reached nearly three times the height of the man.
It's going to kill him, Josh murmured.
Dee's sword flared bright blue, and then the small man threw himself backward toward the Torque Alta, bringing the sword around in a short arc. The sudden movement seemed to surprise the creature, but it easily batted aside the blade, and then it froze. Where the blade had touched it, a thin sheath of ice grew up the beast's arm, tiny crystals sparkling in the early morning sunshine. The ice coated the Torque Alta's chest and flowed down its massive legs and up his shoulders and head. Within a matter of heartbeats, the creature was encased in a block of blue-veined ice. Dee picked himself up off the ground, dusted off his coat, and then, without warning, hammered on the ice with the hilt of his sword. The block shattered into millions of tinkling pieces, each one containing a fragment of the Torque Alta.
One of the elemental swords, Scatty remarked grimly. Excalibur, the sword of ice. I thought it was lost ages past, thrown back into the lake when Artorias died.
Looks like the doctor found it, Flamel murmured.
Josh discovered that he wasn't even surprised to hear that King Arthur had been real, and he found himself wondering which other legendary figures had really existed. They watched as Dee hurried back into the undergrowth, heading for the other side of the huge treehouse, where the sounds of battle were loudest. The smell of smoke was stronger now. Sharp and bitter, it curled and twisted around the tree, carrying with it the reek of ancient places and long-forgotten spices. Wood snapped and cracked, sap boiled and popped, and the deep bass thrumming was now strong enough to set the entire tree vibrating.
"I'll clear the way,"
Scatty said as she darted through the vines. Almost immediately, a trio of the birdmen came winging toward her, followed by two of the cat people running on all fours.
"We've got to help her," Josh said desperately, though he'd no idea what he could do.
"She is Skatok. She doesn't need our help," Flamel said. "She'll lead them away from us first."
Skatok raced into the undergrowth, running lightly, her heavy boots making no sound on the soft earth. The birds and cats followed.
"She'll back herself up against something, so that they can only come at her from one side. Then she'll turn to face them."
Josh watched as Scatty spun and faced her attackers with her back to a gnarled oak tree. The cat creatures reached her quickly, claws flashing, but her short swords were quicker and struck sparks from their claws. A bird creature swung in low, huge wings flapping, talons extended. Driving the sword in her left hand into the ground, she caught the creature's extended wrist and yanked it out of the air, then tossed it into the middle of the snarling cats. The bird instinctively lashed out at the cats, and suddenly the animals were fighting among themselves. Two more bird people immediately dropped onto the cats with a hideous squalling. Scatty yanked her sword out of the ground and used it to beckon to Flamel and Josh. Flamel tapped Josh's shoulder.
"Go. Get to Skatok."
Josh turned to look at the alchemist.
"What about you?" "I'll wait a moment, then follow and protect you."
And even though Josh knew Flamel had placed them in terrible danger, he had no doubts that the alchemist would watch his back. He nodded, then turned and burst through the curtain of vines and ran, clutching his sister tightly to his chest. Away from the shelter of the tree, the noise of battle was incredible, but he concentrated on the ground directly ahead of him, watching for roots or other irregularities in the earth that could trip him. In his arms, Sophie stirred. Her eyes flickered, and she started to move. Josh tightened his grip.
"Stay still,"
he said urgently, though he wasn't sure if she could hear him. He shifted direction, moving to the right, away from the struggling creatures, but he couldn't help noticing that when they were badly injured, they reverted to their original bird and cat shapes. Two bemused-looking cats and three ragged crows picked themselves out of the dirt and watched him run past. Josh could hear Flamel running behind him, could smell the mint on the morning air as the alchemist worked his magic.
Another 10 or 15 footsteps would take him to Skadi, and Josh knew that once he was with her, he was safe. But when he reached Skadi, he was just in time to see her eyes widen in horror. He looked over his shoulder and saw a tall woman with the head and claws of a sleek feline, wearing the robes of ancient Egypt, leap at least 20 feet and land squarely on Nicholas Flamel's back, driving him into the ground. A curved, sickle-like claw shot out and sliced his short staff neatly in two. Then the creature threw back her head and hissed and spat triumphantly. Chapter 27 Perronel Flamel was moved from her tiny underground cell by 4 small guards dressed entirely in black leather, their heads and faces concealed behind motorcycle helmets. She wasn't entirely sure that they were human. Certainly, she could detect no trace of an aura, a heartbeat, or even breathing from the figures. As they crowded around her, she caught the faintest hint of something old and dead, like rotten eggs and overripe fruit. She thought they might be simulacra, artificial creatures grown in vats of putrid bubbling liquid. Perronel knew that Dee had always been fascinated by the idea of creating his own followers, and had spent decades experimenting with golems, simulacra, and homunculi. Without saying a word, and with jerky gestures, the 4 figures ushered her out of the cell and down a long, narrow, dimly lit corridor. Perronel deliberately moved slowly, giving herself time to gather her strength and absorb impressions of the place. Jefferson Miller, the ghost of the security guard, had told her that she was in the basement of Enoch Enterprises, west of Telegraph Hill, close to the famous Coit Tower. She knew she was deep underground. The walls ran with moisture, and the air was so cold that it plumed in clouds before her face. Now that she was out of the cell and away from its protective spells and charms, she felt a little of her strength begin to return.